Welcome to the Commune Podcast. My name is Jeff Krasno. Today, I am thrilled to feature yet another episode in our series on the Commune Podcast called Ask Dr. G. So we are consistently in receipt of fascinating questions from our Commune community regarding health and well-being. And I simply cannot imagine anyone better in the world to answer these inquiries than my friend, Dr. Sarah Gottfried. And Dr. G is a Harvard-educated physician, researcher, and educator. She received the moniker of Dr. G from the Philadelphia 76ers, for whom she serves as health coach. She has led many Commune courses on the topics of perimenopause and menopause, and happily we seem relatively successful in luring her to Commune Topanga on a regular basis, where she is leading retreats, often with my better three-quarters, Skylar Grant. So you can be part of the conversation and submit a question at onecommune.com/askdrg. To learn more from Sarah Gottfried, you can watch her free Commune Masterclass, Women, Food, and Hormones, at onecommune.com/menopause. We're so grateful to those of you who write us reviews on Apple Podcasts that we created a special offer just for you, 30 days of free Commune membership. That's all access for an entire month. Just scroll down to the review section and tap write a review, then email support@onecommune.com with a screenshot of said review, preferably a good one, to receive your free all access for 30 days. Today's episode is the first installment of a two-parter, where Dr. G and I discuss healthy adaptive stress responses versus unhealthy maladaptive responses to stress. We explore the interconnectedness of stress, trauma, and physiological and psychological health, and how measuring biomarkers like cortisol and heart rate variability offer insights into how the body responds to stress and can also guide interventions to chronic disease. Sarah and I also share our personal experiences of how chronic stress impacted our own well-being and what we're doing to overcome its impact. As always, this was a fascinating conversation, and I hope you find it enjoyable and useful. So without further delay, I present to you Dr. Sarah Gottfried. Dr. Sarah Gottfried, so great to be with you once again.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
And we are about to embark on a number of really interesting episodes, really centered around your new book, your sixth book, believe it or not, called The Autoimmune Cure. And we're going to be talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy, about autoimmune disease, around trauma, around all sorts of other kinds of modalities and praxies. So perhaps you can talk about what represents healthy versus an unhealthy or maladaptive stress response.
With stress response, you know, there's a few different factors that I think about. And I always think in terms of measuring first, because I think that's a way of creating specificity around it. So when the stress response was first studied, and I joke sometimes that it feels like to me that Harvard Medical School takes credit for pretty much everything, whether they were the first or not, but Walter Cannon at Harvard in the 30s studied the stress response. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who coined the phrase sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight. And in the autonomic nervous system, kind of the way that you respond to stress automatically, you've got the sympathetic nervous system, kind of the on button for stress. And then you've got the parasympathetic nervous system, kind of the off button, which I now think of more as stay and play. Hmm. I used to think of it as rest and digest, but that didn't capture me quite as much as stay and play. And that stress response is really designed anciently to be triggered not that frequently.
Right.
You know, maybe like once a month, once a quarter, you're dealing with some sort of predator on the savanna. So you activate your sympathetic nervous system. you have a release of adrenaline, your cortisol rises, and you've got, as a result of those hormonal triggers, you've got this ability to, you raise your blood sugar. That's one of the effects of cortisol. And so your muscles can soak up that glucose and use it to fight or to flee, run. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is that we're now exposed to that stress response much more often. It might be an email that you get in the morning. It might be the food that you're eating. You know, there's so many ways that our stress response system can become overburdened and triggered too often. So how do you look at that? Well, you can look at it by measuring some of these biomarkers. You can look at cortisol. So pretty much every patient I see, every client I take care of, I'm going to do a 4 or 5 point cortisol. I'm going to look at their cortisol awakening response. What happens to cortisol when they first wake up in the morning, 30 minutes later, 60 minutes later, I'll look in the saliva. And then I'll look at it throughout the day because that's such a critical biomarker and indicator signal of what is happening with the stress response. There's other things you can measure too, such as heart rate variability, that time between each of your heartbeats, which, you know, your heart's not like a metronome. When you've got 60 beats per minute, it's not beating every second. It's 0.88 seconds, then 1.12. So it varies, and that variation is a measure of the balance between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. And then there's another layer of homeostasis in the stress response and what works for those who are assigned male at birth and those that are assigned female at birth, because that initial research by Walter Cannon was done on men and assumed to apply to women. And women have some nuances and differences in the way that they respond to stress. First, we know from the American Psychological Association that women experience more stress. They may or may not have more stress, but they perceive more stress, about 10% more than men. They experience more trauma. They've got more sexual trauma, especially as children. And women, not just, you know, when you look at this fight or flight response, women do other things that may be less functional in terms of being faced with a big stressor and then being able to resolve that stress response. Right. So women, I think of more as fight, flight, freeze, fawn. And the freeze response, you know, just kind of like feeling like, oh my God, you know, deer in headlights, or the fawn response, let me people please, let me kind of solve this problem. Let me make things better for you in your environment. Those things tend to lead to a stress response that doesn't complete. It lives on in the body. There's a signature of that stress that continues in your system. And we tend to see that more in women than we do with men. And then Shelley Taylor at UCLA also found that women do better in terms of resolving the stress response if they tend to befriend. So that's like a whole other piece of oxytocin and how that changes the hormonal milieu that we're talking about. So getting back to homeostasis, what I think is hopeful here and what I've certainly seen in my clients and also in myself is that your dynamic range, kind of your ability to roll with what's coming your way from the external environment, that can change. Like, you can train yourself to have a wider dynamic range, to be able to roll with the punches, with more punches. And so that's the empowering message here, that you can actually, you can change your stress response.
Yeah. Skylar encourages me to, quote unquote, eat some dirt. and this should not, it's psychologically, basically, but she's also creating a metaphor there. And of course, this is not to justify insult or odious behavior or neglect, et cetera. But it's also, there is some wisdom in the, you know, application of Stoic principles, for example, in building one's own psychological immune system. So in your book, you talk a little bit about the hygiene hypothesis and how in certain Western cultures that are, addicted to antibacterial soaps and things like that. Essentially, we have not been able to properly build our immune systems because immune systems from a very, very young age are built through exposure to low-grade pathogens, which over time, through B-cell memory, et cetera, like that the body learns and then remembers, at least the immune system, which is fascinating, what is self and what isn't self. Until it doesn't, and we'll get there. And in the same way, if you are able to build your psychological immune system through low-grade exposure to pathogenic thoughts or pathogenic insult or social media or the purposeful leveraging of your own negativity bias by YouTube, Twitter, you know, Facebook, fill in the blank, then you can solve for this evolutionary mismatch that you just so articulately described. Essentially, this notion that we're always getting chased by the saber-toothed tiger, such that this endocrine cascade is always happening. And maybe you could actually take a moment to describe how, for example, chronically elevated cortisol levels might present metabolically, like in the gut, in the immune system. And then, you know, because that way we can truly understand how our reaction or response to stress or trauma actually shows up in our physiology.
Yeah. And cortisol is a good one because most people can relate to, you know, the most common stress hormone that we're looking at. So, yes, what happens, you know, for people who are in a state of homeostasis, and I've got a few patients like this, maybe a dozen, they are exposed to a stressor and they raise their cortisol in response. Their blood sugar goes up a little bit and then they return to homeostasis. They return to a state of balance. They don't have kind of this dysregulated cortisol signal that persists. And then the other 30,000 patients that I've taken care of, there's a level of dysregulation. So what I found when I first measured my cortisol, I was in my 30s. I had had one kid and I was experiencing symptoms that could map to high cortisol. So I had a lot of belly fat that I couldn't lose. I had this baby weight that just was entrenched. I had PMS, premenstrual syndrome. I had no sex drive. I was working in McMedicine at the time. So I was working long days, like 12-hour days, seeing about 30 to 40 patients a day. But I went to my doctor and I had my list of woes. And he suggested a birth control pill and to go on a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And I just got so angry in that moment when he was suggesting these things. And for my belly fat, he said, you know this, it's simple math, Sarah. Eat more and calories eat less and exercise out. More. Yeah. And that'll help you with your belly fat. So I left his office angry and I went to the lab and ran a hormone panel. And my cortisol was so high. It was about three times what it should be in my blood, total cortisol. So that was leading to moodiness. There's some debate about this idea of pregnenolone steel, but there's this idea that if you're making so much cortisol in your system, you may not be making some of the other sex hormones like DHEA and testosterone. Maybe that's one of the reasons why my libido was lower, wasn't making as much progesterone. So I had a harder time soothing myself. So when you look at the data on high cortisol levels, there's a pattern that emerges. And I wrote about this in my first book. There's metabolic dysfunction because cortisol's got a number of jobs in the body. It raises blood sugar, it modulates your immune system, and it also raises your blood pressure. So my high cortisol was associated with these mood changes. It's a wear and tear hormone. So it breaks down muscle. Some of the precursors to the signal that raises cortisol, like corticotropin releasing hormone, directly increases intestinal permeability. Mm-hmm. So it leads to so-called leaky gut and more food reactions and more inflammation because 70% of your immune system is in your gut. And so it's getting triggered by these things that are passing through the tight junctions. Psychiatrists use cortisol as a suicide marker. About 50% of people with depression have high cortisol levels. And it's a little hard to know what's the chicken and what's the egg, like which came first, but cortisol is when it's dysregulated. When you're not in homeostasis, cortisol is like a bully. Mm-hmm. And it's not a democracy. Like cortisol is, because it's so primary and it's so involved in life, in your daily function, like you can do without estrogen, you can do without testosterone. Life is better with them for sure, but you can't live without cortisol. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a democracy, it is a dictatorship, and not a benevolent dictatorship when you're out of homeostasis.
Right.
Hello, Commune listeners, it's Jeff, and if you are looking for science-backed recommendations to take control of your own health, well, we have an exciting opportunity coming up. Dr. Andrew Huberman, the well-known neuroscientist and host of the number one health and fitness podcast, Huberman Lab, will be hosting an exclusive live webinar for the Commune audience on September 22nd, at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Now, in this 45-minute live learning session, he will be sharing the best daily and weekly trackable health metrics, everything from sleep quality to nervous system recovery, as well as less frequent tests to consider, including blood, cognitive, and DNA testing. Now, to sign up, both to attend live and to receive the video replay of the webinar, just go to onecommune.com/health. I'm personally so excited to hear what Andrew will be sharing about how to objectively measure your health and performance and how to use those metrics to optimize your health. So go to onecommune.com/health to RSVP. Now, this event is made possible by Inside Tracker, the leading longevity and health span optimization platform. Inside Tracker analyzes your biological data to give you a clear picture of what's going on inside your body and then provides a customized action plan based on your biology. I personally use Inside Tracker and I love it. So get 20% off Inside Tracker by visiting insidetracker.com/commune.
As it pertains to like sleep-wake cycle or your circadian rhythm, it's also on this teeter-totter with melatonin, for example. And there's a time of day at which melatonin would naturally secrete if properly stimulated early in the day. Some of that has to do with exposure to blue light, etc. But the disruption and the dysregulation of cortisol can spill over into this disrupted sleep patterns. Can raise my hand and volunteer for that study.
Right.
And then we know all the knock-on impacts of disrupted sleep, from lack of memory consolidation and learning and insulin sensitivity, or really the building of insulin resistance. It seems like I've read things that like even one night of bad sleep might result in insulin resistance, failure to activate like the lymphatic system, like the kind of cleaning out of dysfunctional proteins in your brain at night. And then just general like infirmities of one's own direct experience, like being crabby and eating comfort foods and all the things that you might do, or over caffeinating if you're not getting enough sleep. So the kind of failure of homeostasis around cortisol seems to be kind of in stark relief. It's at the front of the line in terms of primacy of things that we can focus on.
It's at the front of the line, but I would also say, let's take a wider view. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the stress response system, I think it's helpful to think about, okay, what are the parts of the body, the systems of the body that are the most vulnerable? Mm. And so we've talked about some of them, but I like to put them together as the PINE network.
Yeah.
So PINE, psychoimmunoneuroendocrine network. And these are the parts of the body that are the most vulnerable to toxic stress, to a loss of homeostasis. So yes, cortisol in some ways is the most intuitive. So that's the E of PINE, and that's your endocrine system. Cortisol also affects other hormones, such as the ones we talked about, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, oxytocin. But you can't forget about the immune system.
That's right.
You know, especially nowadays, there's less conversation about it. There's less specificity. It's, in some ways, it's a more complex system to really wrap your head around. And then you also can't forget about the nervous system and sort of the way, you know, heart rate variability is one measure of that. But just in thinking in terms of your vagus nerve and what you do to improve vagal tone, and then P, your psychology. So I want people to not just pay attention to cortisol at the front of the line. It's a good one to focus on, but we want to think about this whole network.
I think this is a good moment to help people understand trauma and the nature of trauma and go upstream for a moment of what is the provenance of a lot of this stress. And then we can go downstream and see how that can manifest in this panoply of presentations that we've sort of put under this rubric of autoimmunity. So let's go upstream for a second. How do you understand trauma, and are there different ways to understand it?
First, I want to say that trauma was not a big part of my medical education and training. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, I would say, trauma and nutrition were sadly lacking. And I really didn't think about it. I didn't look for it in my patients and clients until the past 5 to 10 years. So the way I think of trauma, we've got so many folks that have defined it beautifully for us, like Gabor Mate and Bessel van der Kolk. And what I've learned from Gabor Mate is that it's not so much what happened to you, although we want to know about that and we want to know the details. It's the way that the dysregulation lives on in your body. Mm-hmm. So it's the way that toxic stress, the way that it becomes embedded, biologically embedded, and lives on in your system. And the focus so much, especially with psychiatrists or people who work on psychology and the mind, is the psychological consequences of trauma. Mm-hmm. So the post-traumatic stress disorder, the depression, anxiety, disordered eating, obsessive-compulsive disorder, attention deficit disorder. So we tend to focus on the psychology of it.
Right.
And what I'm really interested in is the biological ramifications.
Right.
So the way that biological embedding might affect your blood sugar, might affect your difficulty with sleeping, might affect your relationships, might affect your ability to accomplish your mission. So I like to focus on the entire perspective, especially those biological pieces that we can objectively measure and we can work to improve.
Right. There are many, I think, very cogent definitions. And Peter Levine uses the tyranny of the past, which I've co-opted and try to give him credit wherever I can. But indeed, I think the good news here is that it is not the event itself. It is the valence and salience emotionally that we assign to that event going forward. So, you know, you can't really go back to the past and change the underlying event, but you can have some agency over your continued response to that event, right?
That's right. And I, you know, I think of this particular piece as stuckness. Mm-hmm. So are you someone who had a traumatic event and you were able to process it? Maybe you were surrounded by people who helped you sort it through, whether you were a child or a survivor or adult survivor of 9/11. Or were you someone who was more solitary and kind of left alone with this difficult overwhelming event that occurred. Mm-hmm. So there's a stuckness that I think is important. And some people, despite their best efforts, they spend decades in talk therapy and still feel stuck.
Yeah.
And we're just starting to understand why that is.
Yeah. Why is the standard of care there seem to be not completely acceptable?
Well, the standard of care, I would say, misses the mark. Yeah. So the standard of care for if you take a diagnosis like post-traumatic stress disorder, if you look at the military system and what the Veterans Administration does to deal with PTSD, the standard of care is that someone with PTSD is sent to therapy with or without selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And there's three that are FDA approved for post-traumatic stress disorder. When I was looking at the data associated with this, the outcome studies that we have, the efficacy of talk therapy for PTSD is on the order of about 30%. 30%! Even when you add a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor with or without therapy, the efficacy is still about 30%. I think that's appalling. You know, I've got a pretty high ACE score. If I knew in my 20s that talk therapy had an efficacy of 30%, if I had an informed consent process, I don't think I would have done it. Like, I spent so many hours and so many thousands of dollars for a pretty low efficacy. And part of why this is important is because it's led to the rise of more trauma-informed care. It's led to the rise of interventions like EMDR, Peter Levine, somatic experiencing, more embodiment practices like Bessel van der Kolk talks about in The Body Keeps the Score. And it's also led to a reimagining of psychedelic-assisted therapy, which has an efficacy in post-traumatic stress disorder that's about double the standard of care. That's really exciting.
Yeah, that's huge. It's really the biggest development in perhaps multiple generations in terms of care. Definitely want to get there. I want to just hover over trauma for just another moment, because I think most people associate trauma with like a very severe acute event. And it can be an incident that involves sexual assault or rape or racism or very severe neglect. But is there a form of small T chronic trauma that seems to produce the same detrimental knock-on impacts?
Well, this relates to the idea that it's not so much what happened to you, it's the level of dysregulation that is in your system as a result of the event.
Right.
So yes, there are the capital T traumas that most people would agree are traumatic. The Holocaust, a genocide, surviving 9/11, a near fatal car crash. And then there's these small T traumas that can either individually or in aggregate overwhelm the stress response. And that could be things that are more like misattunement, a breakup with someone that you love, conflict in your marriage. So yes, both are important. And as I was looking at the data, one of the things that I found so interesting is that whether it's a big T trauma or a small T trauma, there's so much bioindividuality in terms of the response to it. And we can make some statements about that. I mean, even if you look at those that are assigned male at birth, those that are assigned women, female at birth, when they are exposed to the same trauma, women often have higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's a lot of moving parts here, but I think it's important to realize, you know, some folks say to me when I'm asking them about adverse childhood experiences or what kind of toxic stress they've got in their life, they'll say, oh, I don't have trauma. You know, I had a happy childhood. And then when you get into the details and you actually ask them to fill out an ACE questionnaire, it turns out Pretty much all of us have had a traumatic load.
Thank you so much for listening to our Ask Dr. G series. As I mentioned, we have a special offer for those of you who review the show on Apple Podcasts. It really makes a huge difference in the discoverability of the show. So by writing a review, you will receive all access to the Common Course platform, which features over 145 courses on health and wellness for a whole month. Just scroll down to the review section and tap write a review. Then email support@onecommune.com with a screenshot of your glowing review to receive your free all access for 30 days. Of course, feel free to reach out to me directly any old time with suggestions, criticism of the constructive ilk at jeffk@onecommune.com. Lastly, but certainly not leastly, I would like to thank the folks that make this show possible week over week over week, including Jacob Lau, Megan Stone, Violet Augustine, Cooper Mall, Savannah Alcala, Wellington Gonzalez, my man, and Ryan Tillotson. What a team. Okay, that's all from the Commune for today. My name is Jeff Krasnow, and I am here for you.